Welcome to the Big World Made Small podcast for the adventure traveler. I'm thrilled you're here. My name is Jason Elkins, and in addition to being your host, I'm also a former U.S. Army paratrooper, third-generation commercial hot air balloon pilot, paramotor pilot, ex-Montana fly fishing guide, advanced open water scuba diver, and a full-time nomad that's visited more than 30 countries on six continents. As a seasoned adventure travel expert with a passion for creating and sharing meaningful experiences, I'm on a quest to impact the lives of adventure travelers, tour operators they rely on, and the communities that host them. Every week, I bring you exclusive interviews with fascinating adventure tourism experts who have agreed to share their personal stories, favorite destinations, and some invaluable travel insights they've picked up along the way. We'll enjoy a casual conversation, create some connections, and likely share some laughs. It's my hope that by the end of each episode, this big world will feel just a bit smaller. Let's get started, shall we?
And I'd always been taught by my dad, just make sure that you don't underdress. Make sure that, if anything, you overdress, you can always kind of, bring that back. So I turned up to the interview in a suit and a tie and got shown through into a room to sit on a beanbag on the floor. And the two people who were doing the interview just looked at me, and I'm sitting on the floor in a suit and a tie, and I just looked at them. We are actually seeing, an epidemic of loneliness across, a lot of places around the world, but especially in the States. And this is a great opportunity, and travel is a great opportunity just to reach out, connect with people. The scale of these walls of ice that greet you when you see Antarctica for the first time, it's just the whole continent feels like it's a huge ice fall just, tumbling into the ocean.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Big World Made Small podcast for the adventure traveler. So happy to have each and every one of you back here today to join us with our special guest. Super excited about this one. This guy's got a lot of interesting experiences and is part of an organization that many of you will recognize the name. So today we've got Tom Smith from Intrepid Travel. Tom, so happy to have you here.
Jason, thanks so much for having me. Really looking forward to it.
We had a conversation earlier on, and you brought up a couple things that I did not know about you. And I thought, man, that's some pretty cool stuff. I know that our listeners are always interested in, just that story. Like, how did you get into this? What do you like most about it? What are some of your fondest memories? It's that same conversation that I know you've had with clients or guests sitting around the dinner table or, around a campfire or something like that. So that's really... So let's jump right in and tell our listeners just a little bit about how did you get into adventure tourism? What were you doing before that? And just kind of what was the shift?
Sure. I mean, to be totally honest, I always thought travel was something you did for fun outside of work. And what you did in work was not travel and sit and do kind of other industries and work in other areas. And that was me. I worked in the pharmaceutical sector for a while. I worked in sales. I worked in finance. And I just kept quitting. And I'd work for 18 months, 2 years, and I'd quit and think, oh, I need to do something else. I need to go and travel. I would do that. I would travel. I'd live the dream for a few months at a time, then run out of money and realize, okay, back to work. And for me, it just didn't even really enter my head that you can work, in travel. And until I thought, there's got to be a better way than this. I can't keep quitting and, using all my money up and then restarting all over again. And so I moved to Australia, actually. After a period of travel in South America, I moved to Australia, met a couple of guys who said, hey, we work at a travel agency. Do you want to join us? And that was where it started, really.
And I can imagine you're like, what? Really? You guys
you get to talk about
this?
Travel for
you
a
work
living?
In this space? And what did your family think when you're like, okay, I found it. I figured it out. Were they supportive or were they like, no, Tom, you really should go back and get a real job? How did they respond?
I think by this point, they realized that it was more than a passing interest in travel. It was more than something that I did or wanted to do for 3 or 4 weeks a year. And so I guess like any parents, they just wanted me to be happy and find something that I'm passionate about. And so, I think when I started working for this travel business in Australia, they thought, this makes sense. This is Tom being able to combine what he's passionate about and still,
you know, and he's actually getting a paycheck.
Career, and he's getting paid for it. So, you know,
perfect.
I'll take that.
Yeah, I've had conversations with my family as well. I remember when I first got into tourism, my brother specifically, I'm going to go be a fly fishing guide in Montana. And he's like, yeah, that's crazy. You can't do that. You're not going to ever da 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 da. And it was the best choice I ever made. I would love to hear the story. Like, you went to Australia for surfing because that's kind of a passion of yours, right?
Yeah,
or was it just part of it? And then how did you actually meet these guys? Because I know there's people out there, man, that I would love to have that happen. I'm curious, what was the specifics of your meeting? Was it at a bar over what are they, 4X beers or a Foster's or something? Or what happened?
It was quite coincidental. So yeah, I'll be totally honest. I went to Australia because I didn't know what else to do. I didn't want to go back to the UK. It would have been, just before Christmas. I thought, I don't want to go back to the UK. It's the middle of winter there. It's the middle of summer in Australia. I can go there, be warm and surf. That sounds like a good plan. I'd met actually in South America a couple of great Aussie guys, and they were like, oh, yeah, why don't you just come over here? You'll work something out. So I went over there and then found myself in Byron Bay, which is a great spot for, just hanging out, surfing. It's a great spot on the east coast of Australia. And I was literally walking down the street and I got accosted by a guy who was standing outside of a travel agency. And he said, oh, are you traveling up the east coast? Do you want to go to Whitsunday Islands? Do you want to go to Fraser Island? Got chatting. And I said, no, not really. I'm, potentially looking to stay, looking for some work. And he said, oh, what do you do? And I said, oh, I've got a variety of different experiences by this point. Nothing longer than about 18 months anywhere. And he said, oh, well, you seem to be pretty confident, pretty chatty. You obviously love travel. If you think you could do this, come and have an interview. And that was
it. When he said, do you think you could do this? Is it literally stand out in front of the tour desk and grab people walking by and ask them how long they're going to be here and which tours they want to book?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
There was a few kind of backpacker travel agencies, we'd call them. You're looking for pretty much people like myself, young people, probably aged between about 20 and 30 generally, that, were having a good time or wanted to go and have a good time, wanted to experience, a few different places around Australia. And we would literally hang outside the front of the store in flip-flops and shorts and just chat away and see if we could meet some people who wanted to go and, go on some boats and have some beers and have some fun.
That is so cool, because I suspect almost everybody listening to this podcast has met somebody like that. If you've, left the country and been in any touristy area or along the beach or something and have had that run in with some, I don't mean run in a negative way, but it sounds it, doesn't it? So let's rephrase that. Has had the opportunity to interact with somebody who's selling tours on the sidewalk. And how long ago was that?
Wow. That would have been in the beginning of 2013, I think.
10 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm going to say something that maybe you wouldn't say, but just an observation that, for anybody that read the bio or listened to the introduction of this episode. So you went from that to being a vice president of, is it sales and marketing for Intrepid Travel?
Yes.
And 10 years.
Yeah.
I can imagine your parents are not questioning any decisions anymore. even if secretly they were, you've done a great job of, turning it into a quote unquote real job. And not that selling tours on the beach is not a real job. It's just, isn't it interesting? I guess the reason I bring it up is it's so interesting when you find something you're passionate about, you're really excited about, how it can look so different than back when you were doing things you weren't that passionate about and weren't that excited about. You're a pretty good example of that.
And look, there's a lot of useful skills learned. I mean, trying to, you know, get people to sign up to things, you know, using a lot of interpersonal skills, you know, obviously improving communication, trying to read customers and trying to work out, you know, when they're signaling that they might be interested in buying, and working out kind of the best approach. It was really useful. It was hard at times, but also surrounded by great people. I had a lot of great people to learn from. And to be honest, I'd say that's the common thread from then to now, is just being surrounded by people that you can learn so much from, be really inspired by. I think that's probably the common thread, actually.
It is pretty cool, because I think there's other stories like yours where people came in doing other things, and then they kind of like the light bulb goes off, and wow, I can actually work in an industry that I'm super excited about. And they all bring their own set of skills, whether they were, you know, engineers, so maybe they're really good at the logistical part of it, or sales like yourself, because you'd mentioned that you did sales before that. It is pretty interesting when you get, especially an organization like Intrepid, I'm sure, where you know, you guys have people from all different backgrounds working together, and that is super cool. So you're in Australia, selling tours in Australia. And what was the next step in that 10-year journey to where you are now?
Sure. So I was there probably two and a half years, something like that. Eventually was kind of responsible for managing the stores across Byron Bay area in Brisbane. So looking after three stores. So again, that was really useful experience as well, managing plenty of people. As you can imagine, it was a pretty relaxed work environment. And, you know, as a manager, that's challenging at times. You know, I was used to
environments.
You know, being used to more corporate environments and coming into that vibe where, you know, it was par for the course that people would be out the night before, and you'd probably seen them out the night before. I've always been a bit of a morning person. You know, I like to get up and go surfing. Obviously, I enjoy a beer too, but I left the big nights out for the other guys. But then as a manager, that's pretty challenging. You know,
you're the one standing there when the clients show up for their surfing lesson, and you know where their guide is. Yeah, I worked with fly fishing guides. I managed the fly fishing lodges, and it's kind of the same. I think it's the same group of guys that go surfing half the year and fishing. I don't know, but
it's more of a lifestyle. Yeah, so I did that.
Which is cool. It's fun being around that.
Right. Love it.
Yeah.
So did that for about 2.5 years. Then I was going back to the UK, or wanted to go back to the UK, but wanted to spend the winter somewhere on the way. There's not a lot in the UK for me in winter. So
I get it.
I again took a bit of a chance. I just emailed about 10 surf businesses, surf hotels, surf schools, and just said, hey, I'm on my way back to the UK from Australia. I'd love to stay and surf and work for you guys. Happy to work for free if you can kind of put me up and make my living costs next to nothing or very low. Here's my CV. You know, by that point, it was kind of a lot of sales, a lot of marketing, and, you know, probably had 2.5 years within the industry at that point. And one guy got back to me, a guy called Abdullah. He managed a surf hotel and camp in a village called Tamrakt, which is about 10 minutes south of Tagazout on the Atlantic coast of Morocco. And he said, sure, come on over. So I'd never been to Morocco, and I flew there to stay for the winter season to work for this organization.
And did you have to do it for free, or did they actually pay you?
So I was totally happy to do it. You know, I said I would, and I meant it. I mean, I had a great lifestyle. Abdullah said, you know, first day, he said, look, if you work for 4 or 5 hours a day, you can surf the rest of the time. That's fine. So nice. I thought 4 to 5 hours work a day. Sure, I can do that and surf the rest of the time. And I did. I did it for free. You know, I stayed for free. I ate for free. I, you know, got transported around and you know, some of the surf instructors, we would go off to surfs when they weren't working. So I really had literally no costs. It was a, you know, pretty remote, you know, there were towns close by, but, you know, it was obviously, you know, as a predominantly Muslim country, it's not a place where there's lots of bars or anything like that. So, you know, we could, you know, buy beer for our guests from, there was a, The underground floor of a French supermarket sold beer and wine, so we could get alcohol where we wanted it. But to be honest, I had no costs. So, you know, I didn't get paid, except when I was leaving at the end of the 3 months. It was really emotional, actually. Like, I really felt connected to the guys. I really loved the people in Morocco. They're just wonderful people. And he did pay me a few hundred euros in the end, which, you know, I really didn't want to accept. It was more of a gesture than anything, but I really, you know, I said I would do it and for free, and I did, and that's what I meant. And so I did take it because I could tell that it was really important to him to kind of thank me in that way. So I did end up getting paid a small amount. Yeah.
I'm so happy that came up, the part of I would do it for free, because like there are people listening to this that may be younger people or older people that are aspiring to get into this industry, and they come from a different type of background, and it can be worthwhile and productive to that approach. I think is really good. I did something similar when I first got into the fly fishing industry. I showed up on Fort Smith, Montana, on the banks of the Bighorn River. And I didn't use the word free, but it was probably pretty obvious by the look on my face when I spoke with people, because I walked in like, look, I will do anything. I will dig holes. I will clean the boats. I will whatever. I just want to be here and I want to learn this business. And someone threw me some keys and said, here, you can manage to lodge. I was way over my head. And they gave me a little bit of money. Sometimes it felt like it was free. But it was just that approach to just like, look, just show up and realize, okay, I don't know much about this. You already did, because you'd worked in specifically surfing, tourism as well. But it worked really well for me. And it obviously 8 years prior to the role that you're in now. So I just wanted to highlight that in case anybody's listening to this, trying to, instead of spending 3 months sending out resumes, maybe just show up and say, look, I'm here. You don't have to pay me. I just want to learn the business. And you'll get further in 3 months of that than you probably will.
I was going to say, totally. And look, the people that you meet, you know, the connections that you make. And for me, you know, I ended up doing a lot of stuff that I was also way in over my head. I just didn't know what I was doing, but you know, you could work it out, right? Like, you know, I'd done a bit of marketing in my previous role in Australia, but this was, to be honest, probably about 90% marketing. You know, I was all of a sudden, you know, editing the website and writing blogs and, you know, trying to build relationships with local travel agencies. And, you know, there were definitely things that I'd never done before that actually, by the time I left Morocco and did go back to the UK in the end and, you know, thought, right, now I want to try and find a job in a, you know, company that I really feel will be a great home for me going forward, that actually being able to talk to that experience that I got in Morocco, you know, across a whole area, you know, a number of areas of marketing that, yeah, you could go and learn that course. You could go to school to do a master's or do whatever, do a course in marketing. But, you know, being able to be there on the job and listening and learning from other people, you know, it certainly helped me to get my job at Intrepid.
And you've got kind of a portfolio. You could say, look, this is what I've done. And it's directly tied to tourism. So if you go to you know, sign up for a 3 month or 6 month or longer, maybe 4 year marketing degree program. Yeah. Okay. You're going to have a portfolio and great. I see that you were able to duplicate the Netflix website. That's great. but I actually spoke with someone earlier today and they said, you know, it's hard to find somebody that really kind of has some understanding and experience of marketing that also has some understanding and experience in tourism, specifically adventure tourism. Because sometimes those two, you know, sometimes that's two different personality types that come together. So that's a brilliant approach. And Morocco's on my list. I love Moroccan food. So I'm going to ask you, what's your favorite Moroccan dish that you remember? It's a little off topic, but.
I mean, it's a classic, but a tagine is just so good.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the pots that they make them in. It's obviously the ingredients being super fresh. You know, I didn't eat any processed food at all in you know, 3 or 4 months that I was there. I mean, I ate, you know, three huge meals a day. I couldn't do it these days, but then I was, you know, surfing for 2 or 3 hours a day, and I could just eat whatever I wanted. It was great.
It's so I'm actually surprised I haven't been. When I was living in Vermont working for Orvis Travel, and I had 3 tagines in my house. I only ever used one at a time, but I was so excited. I was like, oh, look, that's a bigger tagine. I didn't need the big one, but it is. It's just good and it's fun. So I thought you might say tagine. okay, where were we? That's pretty cool. Well, okay, so did you go straight from Morocco then? You went back to England because it wasn't winter.
Yep.
And I get that. I'm done living in the north in the cold. But you're in Toronto now, right?
Yep.
Okay. So
where are you going with that?
Does Intrepid, they're not doing the whole work remotely from Costa Rica thing, or what's
I mean, look, I had to go back to the UK at that time. I mean, I say back to the UK, it was via Central America for a couple of months, so I didn't go immediately back to the UK. But then at that time, you know, I was looking to stay in the UK and, you know, just actually my sister helped me out. She worked in the tourism industry in the UK at that time. She still works in the tourism industry, but in New Zealand now. And she actually wrote a list of companies that she thought I would like. Because to be honest, I hadn't worked in the tourism sector in the UK. I didn't know that many businesses. You know, most of my personal travel, I just had not necessarily either had the money to or wanted to travel on a tour, because I just didn't know the kind of companies were out there. You know, I was local buses and staying in as, you know, cheaper places as I could find. So I just didn't have a network in the UK. So she literally wrote the names of about 8 to 10 companies on a piece of paper, and I just set about harassing them, really.
All right. We got it. Tell me a little bit more about that. So 8 to 10 companies. Was Intrepid the one that you landed at initially when you went to the UK, or was there an in-between, or what?
No, so they're all kind of adventure travel companies, or companies that my sister thought I would like from a values perspective. And so, yeah, that I applied to all of them, or sent CVs to all of them, and got interviewed by 3, and Intrepid was the one I eventually picked. The interview story is quite funny, actually. Well, I think it's quite funny.
Okay, please share it.
Okay, so I, you know, like I said, sent CVs off, tried to, you know, get anybody to kind of pay me any attention, which, you know, when you're looking for a job, that's obviously what you have to do. And got an interview with Intrepid for a, you know, entry level marketing role, you know, bottom rung on the ladder. But I thought, you know, I really liked the marketing side a little bit more than the sales. I thought it's kind of storytelling, and I like telling stories. So I think, you know, I could do that. And the interview, the only thing that they said to me about the interview was, the first 10 minutes of the interview are yours to do whatever you want. And I just thought, okay, I do not know what to do here. You know,
No pressure.
Yeah, right. I thought, okay, it's an adventure travel company. I don't really think, you know, PowerPoint presentation was the vibe that they would want. It's interesting because now our recruitment policies are far more, I guess, structured and less random. But this was, you know, like okay. I said, eight.
So anybody that's listening to this that gets an interview at Intrepid, you probably don't need to come up with a 10-minute.
Correct. I just set about thinking, what do I do here? I really just didn't know. And then
Tom, was that like on the spot? Like you walked in the door and they said you got 10 minutes?
No. They told me in advance. Yeah, they told me in advance, you know, it'll be a, whatever it was, an hour interview. The first 10 minutes are yours to do whatever you want.
And if that goes well, the rest of the 50 minutes we'll use. And otherwise you can do whatever you want with those two.
Maybe, yeah. Got an hour of your life back. And I came up with an idea, and I told my brother, and he said, I don't know, this is maybe not a good idea, for reasons which will become obvious, actually became obvious during the interview. So anyway, I thought, I'm going to go for it. I'm going to go in there. And on the way to the interview, I stopped in a confectionery store and bought 3 chocolate bars. And I went into the interview, or, you know, got to the Intrepid offices. And the first thing actually that I noticed, and this is now I look back and just kind of have my head in my hands and just think, oh, what were you doing? But, you know, in my thoughts, it was, you know, a relatively big, you know, company, you know, global business. And I'd always been taught by my dad, you know, just make sure that you don't underdress. Make sure, you know, if anything, you overdress, you can always kind of, you know, bring that back. So I turned up to the interview in a suit and a tie and got shown through into a room to sit on a beanbag on the floor. And the two people who were doing the interview just looked at me, and I'm sitting on the floor in a suit and a tie. And I just looked at them. I thought, I'm just gonna take this off, take the tie. I'm just gonna take this jacket off too, because by this point I'm sitting on a beanbag on the floor in a suit. And I thought, I've slightly misjudged this situation. I've slightly overdressed. And when I say slightly, I mean considerably overdressed for the uh-huh. situation. But I thought, it's okay, right? So they said, you've got 10 minutes. I said, yep, I know. I put these 3 chocolate bars on the floor. There's 3, by the way, because I didn't know how many people were interviewing me. Mm-hmm. I thought there might be 3. Turns out there was 2. Fine. Put the chocolate bars on the floor. And I just said, I'm going to tell you 3 travel stories. One of them is true. One of them I've made up in advance. And the other I'm going to make up on the spot. And if you get them right, then you get a chocolate bar. That's the prize.
Ah, that's pretty smart. I like it.
I told 3 travel stories and I said, you know, guess which one? And, you know, I tried to think, right, I've got roughly 3 minutes per story. Told these travel stories. And I said, right, guys, over to you. Which one do you think was which? And they got them completely wrong. Completely wrong. And I said, oh, how do we do? I said, guys, you're both totally wrong. And one of the interviewers, who it actually turns out was the managing director of Intrepid in the UK at that time, just looked at me and said, I don't know whether to be concerned about how well you can lie. And that was exactly my brother's concern. Was he said, you can't go into an interview and talk.
I'm a really good liar.
Nonsense, right? But you can't just tell them that you're lying, because then they'll not believe the rest of the stuff that you're saying. But anyway, so I said, yeah, I did think about that. And then before I'd even had a chance to say anything else, he said, but you're going to be working in marketing. It's storytelling. You need that. And at that point, I thought, okay, this guy, you know, for whatever reason, in 10 minutes, he thought, this guy can come in and tell a good story and you know,
we'll give you another 50 about minutes. Him.
Yeah, he, to be honest, he kind of switched off for the rest of the interview. And then it was mainly the other person asking me questions. And then, you know, I got the role. And as I got to know him really well, he was a really quick judge of character, sometimes frustratingly so. You know, he would, you know, make a judgment and I'd say, no, I think, you know, they're going to do really well. And then they'd leave 2 weeks later and he'd say, I told you. So, you know, again, somebody that brought me into Intrepid, and I was really thankful for that, and somebody that, you know, I worked with really closely for a few years.
So Tom, I'm not going to lie, right near the end of that story, I was sitting here wondering if you just made this story. Cause it's pretty damn good.
That's true.
All right. Okay. Oh, wow. Yeah, that's, I get it. I mean, it's all tied into the storytelling. I think your instinct was right there. And I can also see how your brother was. Interesting. All right. Well, that's the best interview story I've ever heard. So, all right. Wow. So you got the job.
Yep.
You said it was, initially, it was kind of an entry-level marketing position.
Yep.
So what's that? What did that look like? And how did you feel about that? And was there a lot of incentive to kind of move up? I'm just trying to imagine what that would look like at Intrepid.
Sure. I mean, look, it really was an entry-level position. And you know, it was putting together content for emails. It was, you know, putting together promo codes for discounts. It was really kind of from the bottom up. And I think, you know, it comes back to what you were mentioning a couple of times about being willing to kind of go in unpaid and just learn. And for me, you know, Intrepid was by far at that point the largest business I'd ever worked in. You know, most other businesses I'd been a part of were, you know, somewhere between 10 and 50 people kind of thing. So, you know, to all of a sudden be in a large global, you know, adventure travel company, I thought, wow, I've got a lot to learn. And so I think it's that humility of coming from a position where I was probably managing, you know, somewhere between 13 and 15 people, to all of a sudden going in and being the one that was, you know, the 10th person, you know, on the ladder at the bottom of the ladder. And there was, you know, 10 levels above me or whatever it was. You know, I think that was humbling, but for me, it was super useful, you know, just learning from the bottom up, how do we build emails for our email marketing and how do we put discounts in market? And, you know, how do we know whether somebody is more likely to book India or Peru in February? And you know, there's no real way to learn that without digging into all the data and playing around in Excel and a lot of our reporting software and things like that. So really it was from the bottom up. And I think that was super useful because then over the following four or five years that I was in the UK, you know, I did progress, and you know, progressed to a marketing manager role, and then ultimately progressed to a marketing director role for the EMEA region, so the Europe, Middle East, and Africa region. And you know, whilst I was pretty confident from a kind of leadership and management perspective, because I had managed people in most of my previous roles, being able to manage people and lead people, having also started, you know, at the bottom rung of the ladder, and you know, having spent, you know, time building emails and doing a lot of the behind the scenes, you know, really kind of manual work, I think that really helped, because I was, you know, guiding people in areas that I'd been there and done it myself. And I just feel like that, you know, gained me a certain amount of credibility and trust from the team.
No, absolutely. I think that is critical. And, you know, as opposed to, you know, consultants saying, hey, you should bring in somebody from the pharmaceutical industry that, you know, that has this marketing experience, and we're going to, I get that completely. I'm curious if you're willing to share, were there moments in the first couple of years that you felt kind of disenchanted or disheartened, like, okay, I really kind of left the regular type of job to go do all this, you know, to go to Australia, to go here, to go there. And now I'm generating discount codes or, you know, segmenting lists for emails. Was it a struggle for you to kind of just stick with it and be persistent to get through that? Or was it just like, hey, I'm an Intrepid and I'm looking at emails and email addresses for people that want to travel, so I'm good with it. I'm just curious what that was like for you.
I loved it. I can honestly say, like, you know, of course, with any role, there's frustrations, but there was nothing where I thought I've made the wrong decision here. And that was primarily because of the people. You know, any role has frustrations, of course, but I really felt like I'd found a work family at Intrepid. You know, right from being recruited to, you know, being people coming in to visit us in the UK office from different parts of the world. And just, you know, everybody from the two founders of Intrepid, you know, they're super humble guys, really easy to get along with. You know, they'll talk to you whether you're, you know, the chief executive or whether you're the new guy that's building the emails, you know, behind the scenes. And for me, that made it worthwhile. You know, I've never been somebody that has kind of cared too much about the financial side of things. I guess I probably have enough inbuilt confidence to think, you know, I'm going to be working for 40 years. I'm pretty confident that at some point I'll get to a level where I'm earning enough money to do everything that I want to do. Plus, right. I have really, you know, not expensive taste, so that's quite easy to achieve that. But, you know, I think it was just the people that made me think, you know, I've made the right decision here. And actually, I still think that 8 and a bit years later.
I would suspect that a company like Intrepid kind of self-selects, maybe not self-selects, but I'm just guessing that a lot of the people that work there have an interest in travel. they probably weren't just going through Craigslist or whatever. And okay, there's a job, I'm going to throw out my resume. And if they did, maybe those aren't the ones that got hired. So it sounds like, you know, kind of what I'm hearing is you found yourself in a situation where you're surrounded by like-minded people that are into adventure travel. And I firmly believe that adventure travel, the two biggest requirements to make it adventure travel or a person, an adventure traveler, not requirements, I wouldn't say, but you know what I mean, is the willingness to step outside your comfort zone and just a curiosity, just an openness to just accept that whatever shows up when I step out of that comfort zone. So even if you're in a you know, entry-level marketing role, if you're surrounded with people that are willing to step outside their comfort zone, which might mean suggesting new ideas, new approaches, learning new things, and they're just curious and open-minded by nature. So when you do present an idea to your supervisor, they're open to listening to it. So if you take a bunch of adventure travelers types, put them into a company, that seems like the culture you're going to end up with. Is that
totally? Totally accurate. You know, I think it's certainly a way that I would characterize the vast majority of people at Intrepid. You know, are people that I would very happily meet on a bus somewhere in Ethiopia, you know, going up into the Simien Mountains and have a lot in common with, whether they are, you know, working in operations in Turkey or in, you know, social media in North America or in, you know, sales in Japan. You know, I just think that Intrepid definitely attracts a certain type of person. And I think what's been interesting, actually, I'd say in the last few years, as Intrepid has become kind of more well known in the purpose space, you know, through certifying as a B Corp and through, you know, the work that the Intrepid Foundation has been doing, that actually, as well as your, you know, your adventure travelers, your people that just, you know, want to work in an industry that they're personally passionate about, what I've noticed is more and more people specifically choosing to kind of target to work at Intrepid because of the values of the business. And I feel like that is something that is, you know, and I'll be totally honest here, you know, when I was 22, 25, you know, the values of a business, I'll be honest, I didn't even really think about it. You know, I just, at that time in my life, I just thought, I want to have as much fun as possible. I want to travel. I like travel. I want to work in travel. So that was my thought process. It's only now working at a kind of more values-led business that really does have a kind of a purpose, as well as, you know, aiming to make a profit, that it's become more important to me. And I guess also, you know, seeing some of the challenges that humans are creating around the world, obviously, you know, it becomes even more important that the way that we travel is super important, rather than just, you know, wanting to travel by any means necessary. I think, you know, we've all got a responsibility to be making sure that we're trying to leave the planet in a better state than we found it. And I've certainly noticed that more in the past 5 years, I would say, of people specifically wanting to join Intrepid because they really care about traveling responsibly or trying to travel sustainably. And that is becoming more of a decision-making factor for people.
Other operators, and I know this is a tough question because there's a wide range, but if we just look at kind of those that would classify them as adventure travel tour operators, do you feel like those operators generally work well together, or do you feel like it's more segmented and divisive? What is your over? I guess I'm asking, what is kind of your overall view of the adventure travel, you know, trade or whatever, and what opportunities are there that an organization like Intrepid can take a leadership role in?
Sure. I guess, yeah, my opinion would be that I do think the companies in the adventure travel space generally have similar mindsets and, you know, do collaborate. You know, we're still a relatively small part of the industry. So, you know, I think we do need to club together to try and influence, you know, what I would refer to as kind of mainstream tourism. You know, if you look at the revenue of adventure tourism versus the money that's spent in mainstream hotels or flights and, you know, all these other businesses that are, you know, much larger than companies like Intrepid, I do think there's probably a need to collaborate more than compete. And I think the other thing is, you know, when it comes to trying to travel in the most sustainable way possible, it shouldn't really be a competition, because if, you know, if everybody travels in the way that Intrepid thinks that, you know, people should travel, then ultimately the planet would be in a better space. So really, it's not something that we necessarily think of as a competitive advantage. What I do think, though, is we really, you know, at Intrepid, we do feel like we have a responsibility as the most well-known travel brand in the sustainable tourism space, that, you know, we do try and set a good example. And I think that's where, you know, a lot of what we've done in terms of, you know, measuring our carbon output or committing to science-based targets like we did in 2021, you know, all of how we've done a lot of these things are open source documents. And actually, we want other tour operators to essentially copy what we're doing, because then the bigger picture is the overall impact on the people and the places that we visit will be better. And so, you know, we can't afford for companies that have a more sustainable approach to tourism to be, you know, trying to shield what they do or hide what they do, because ultimately the bigger issue here is that, you know, we've got a planet which we really need to protect. Well, actually, the planet will be fine. The planet's been here for over, you know, 4 billion years.
A few things on the planet now that are a little bit more vulnerable.
Yeah.
Tom, I heard you say, you know, kind of like get everybody online, you know, as far as traveling the way Intrepid would like them to travel. That's what I heard. So I guess I can't not ask, how would Intrepid like to see the listeners of this show and other travelers traveling? So what does that mean?
Sure. I guess that could mean a lot of different things. It was quite a broad comment.
I wasn't sure if there was like a specific, like you guys have a document, like the way that we want you to travel and it's at the footer of each itinerary. I wasn't sure. So I just felt like I needed to ask. So
I think there's some guiding principles that, you know, we certainly live and breathe at Intrepid, that I think if more people did travel in that way, that, you know, they would ultimately have a better impact. And I think, you know, the number one is trying to travel in a way that benefits local communities as much as possible. So, you know, on an Intrepid trip, we try wherever possible to stay in small, locally run boutique type of accommodation, for example. You know, we try to, again, where is feasible, we try and use public transport on our trips. Not just because it reduces the amount of carbon that is emitted, but also because they're great ways of meeting local people. You know, like I'm sure you've had experiences in the past where you've, you know, been on a train and you've met somebody that has just changed the course of your travels or changed the course of your opinion on something. And that for us is really important. You know, all of our trips are guided by a local. So, you know, immediately from, you know, minute one of the welcome meeting on day one, you know, our customers are with a local person that can, I guess, you know, give them guidance, can allay any fears, can really speak to the local culture with confidence, because they are part of the local community. And so we try and, you know, give that to our customers anyway, but by staying in locally run hotels, by traveling on public transport, by doing homestays in some of our trips where, you know, on those trips that have homestays, they're all just ways of, you know, trying to increase the amount of cultural exchange that can happen between travelers and local people. Because ultimately, I think for me, that is the biggest advantage that travel can offer is just, you know, expanding your perspectives on things. And I think by interacting with people from different cultures and different places, that's where we probably realize, you know, some of our perspectives may not be the be all and end all. And, you know, there may be other ways to look at things that we hadn't even considered before.
So what I hear you saying is kind of make the big world just a little smaller.
Yep.
through perspective shift and social. I want to touch on the public transport, because it's interesting that you say that, because I love public transport. I am Mr. Go Catch the Bus, and I don't need to know where the bus stop is because I watch the locals and I see that if you raise your hand the right way, the bus will stop. And I moved from one side of Medellin to the other side of Medellin the other day. I drugged my bag, you know, three blocks to where I could catch the bus, took the bus to the metro station, jumped on the metro, you know, and I'm the only one on there with my suitcase, but, you know, and then go to the other end, get off and get on another bus. I love it. I think it's the most fascinating way to travel. And I'm envisioning, because I wasn't aware of that aspect with Intrepid. And I've also worked in luxury tourism for a while. And I'm like trying to imagine, okay, and then you're going to show up at the airport. We're going to have our local guide meet you, and he's going to go help you catch the bus. I'm sure it's not like that. I know I'm exaggerating a little bit. But was that a challenge to kind of implement that type of thinking? Because it just sounds like different type of thinking than what I've heard in the past.
Sure. I'd say it is a challenge. You know, not that it was. I think it is. And look, you know, we have different styles of travel. So generally speaking, you know, we have basics, which is our kind of, you know, a lot of our camping trips, for example, you know, African safari trips, for example, are often basics trip. I did a basics trip this year. It was hiking in the Rockies in Canada, and it was a lot of camping. So that's kind of the first style, if you like. And then above that, you have original. So original is generally kind of three-star accommodation, three and a half, something like that. And that's where, wherever possible, we do try and have as much public transport as possible. Then you have comfort, which again is probably 3.5, 4-star, something like that. You know, it does attract a different type of clientele. You know, people that are maybe a little less price sensitive, but maybe a little more comfort focused. And you know, we are trying wherever we can to actually increase the amount of public transport where we can, because obviously from a carbon emissions perspective, it makes a lot of sense. We're trying to reduce the amount of flights that we go on as well. And it's really tricky. You know, after my stint in marketing, I actually moved to Peru to be the general manager of our DMC business in Peru. And, you know, I lived in Lima. We had one office in Lima. We had one office in Cuzco. Now, I have got a bus, you know, I've caught a bus between Cuzco and Lima before. But, you know, it was a long trip. It was not particularly particularly comfortable. And, you know, for me, I did more often than not fly, you know, when I had to go between the two. And we have to be really conscious of that for our customers, you know, especially customers that are, you know, paying to travel on a comfort tour or a premium tour. They do expect a premium level of service, as they should. And so, you know, it's more difficult to say, yep, so you're going to go on a 10-hour bus, you know, on these really windy Andean roads from Lima to Cuzco.
On your $8,000 a week tour.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. So it is a real challenge. And I think, you know, for our product team, they're constantly trying to innovate to find, you know, ways of, you know, helping customers to feel like they're getting the value for money that they've paid for, but also trying to, you know, for the trips to run in a way that is as carbon efficient as possible, and also a way of meeting, you know, local people. So I think we are trying to take as many flights out as we can, for example. So for 2024, we've got, you know, we moved 4,000 flights from our itineraries for 2024. And for some of those, you know, the alternative is or was a really long, you know, ride in a minibus or a bus or on a train. And so we're trying to amend the itineraries to see, you know, what is in between these two places that are 10 hours apart? Like, is there an experience we can offer our customers that, you know, No other tour company stops in between the two because they think, well, let's just fly. It's easier. It's quicker. You know, can we find an experience that is with a local community that maybe is a little
it's going to make it more authentic because everybody else is flying over it.
Exactly. And I think the other thing is, you know, this is something that is really important to us is trying to spread out those tourism dollars. You know, if you stick to the highlights of a particular country, then those communities probably are benefiting from tourism, which is great. But it means that there's plenty of other communities that are not benefiting from that tourism necessarily. So, you know, if we can find little unique places to stay on the way that breaks up a long journey, you know, into a couple of hours either side and shows our customers aside to, you know, Ecuador or Peru that they, you know, didn't see because, you know, they're not on the main tourist tracks, then I think that's a win for everybody.
I was just literally just thinking win-win when you said that, because you're absolutely right. It's win for the community, win for the guest, because they're seeing a place that all their friends and family that went to Guatemala, for example, didn't see. And win for the environment. So that's pretty cool. I'm happy we had that conversation. That was interesting. Because like I see a lot of expats or visitors visiting. I spend quite a bit of time in Colombia. I'm here now, so it's top of my mind. But so many that will not get on the bus because they're just like, they just don't like, nobody's encouraged them to, right? I'm just going to say that. I'll just give them benefit out because nobody has said, hey, look at this. This is cool. Go get on the bus. I love the bus. There's a co-working space that I like to go to and it's like a whole adventure. Every morning I get up, go have my coffee and my croissant, drop my 35 cents in the guy's hand and get on the bus. And most of the time I'm standing up, holding onto the rails and it's like I'm surfing and it's pretty cool. So anybody listening to this, if you've been reluctant to catch a bus in some of these places, do it. You might see some cool stuff that you're not going to see. I mean, people here will get on the bus and they'll sing and they'll entertain and it's like a whole party.
I was going to say, I think the other thing is there's different levels of bus, right? I mean, I've been fortunate enough to spend a lot of time in Central and South America and, the chicken buses are hilarious. I've had babies throw up on me. I've had chickens running around. The chicken buses definitely are an experience, but I've also been on buses that are far better than any bus I've been on in Europe. You can have fully reclining beds on buses, you can have, the AC is good, there's Wi-Fi on buses, there's different levels of bus. So I think,
and still inexpensive. I mean, Mexico, I think it's the red bus. I'm familiar with a few different, I was in Southeast Asia taking these buses and it's like $4, it's like a 4-hour trip and it's like $4 and they're nice buses. You can recline, some of them even have Wi-Fi and and you still probably see some interesting people as well. So you get maybe even a chicken. So that's pretty cool, Tom. And I really want to discuss a specific trip that somebody said, oh, you got to talk to Tom. He just went on this trip not too long ago. And it's a trip I have not been on. I've been on 6 continents, but I'm missing one up till now. And so you're going to share with us a little bit about your trip to your 7th continent. And I'm sure some people could probably guess what that is, because I think it's the 7th. For most people that go there, it's their 7th. I don't know. Was it your 7th?
It was. Yeah.
Okay. So we're talking about Antarctica, right?
Yep. We are.
All right. So tell us what people need to know that are thinking about it, that are excited about it. After we spoke last time, I had a conversation with somebody. I said, I'm going to Antarctica and I'm going to take my son with me. And somebody overheard that. It's just something that people kind of just, imagine. So what can you share of your experience that people should hear?
I mean, the first thing I'd say is it does take a while to get down there. I was living in Toronto.
We were just talking about taking public transport and conserving resources. So tell us about
it is a reality, unfortunately. And so, I did fly down to Ushuaia. Ushuaia, by the way, is absolutely beautiful. I mean, Patagonia and down that southern cone of South America is worth the trip in itself going down there. It's a pretty long sail as well. 2 days across the Drake Passage. We were lucky. I'll be totally honest. We were really lucky. It was not much more turbulent than a pond. It was pretty good on the way. So I went back in February on an Intrepid trip, which has got to be probably the best work trip that I will ever have to do. Getting sent down there for work, we were hosting a few partners on the ship. The ship has a maximum capacity of 200 people. So it's not like one of the huge cruise ships, but it's definitely big enough to feel safe sailing across the Drake Passage. My overriding memory actually of the trip, or what I remember most or remember being most amazed by, was the ice. And I know that sounds completely, probably very minor to people, but when you're surrounded by whales, which were amazing, I'm a massive wildlife lover, so seeing whales was amazing. But the scale of these walls of ice that greet you when you see Antarctica for the first time, it's just, the whole continent feels like it's a huge ice fall just, you know, tumbling into the ocean. And these walls are huge. I mean, the glaciers are, you know, 30, 50, 100 meters tall. And I couldn't get over how much ice there was. And even the icebergs floating around, you know, they float past the ship. And some of them are huge. And they're like deep blue, or they're green, or they're white, and they're funky shapes. You know, I just, that was my overriding memory, actually, was the ice, which is not what I thought I would ever say.
Because sometimes, especially with geographical feature, make sure I'm saying this right, but like a mountain or something, we've seen pictures of it, and oftentimes we show up, and when we see it, we're kind of underwhelmed, I guess.
Yeah.
So for you to call that out specifically, it kind of sounds like it's a little bit of the opposite. Like, wow, that's actually bigger than what I thought. And this isn't just like snow-covered mountains like you might see in Norway. I mean, not that they have glaciers in Norway as well, but
yeah.
But it's just like big chunks of ice, right?
Yeah. I mean, I thought it would be more kind of snow-covered mountains. Actually, the majority of, at least from you know, my memories of it, the majority of it was actually glaciers with the occasional snow-covered mountains there as well. I think the reason why it really blew my mind is the scale of it. And maybe it's just because you can't get the scale, or it's not as easy to get the scale from photos or even videos, yeah. I think. But, you know, the scale of it being right next to it was, you know, the ship felt tiny, and it was, you know, a pretty large ship. So that was pretty amazing. Doing the polar plunge, I mean, I know we've talked a bit about surfing, and you probably think I like cold water. I am a warm weather surfer. Like I'm always wearing a thicker wetsuit than everybody else in the water. I'm not a cold water fan. I know it can do a lot of good for your body. I've read a lot about it. It's just not a thing that I necessarily feel the need to do, but I did feel the need to do the polar plunge. I just thought, when am I ever?
How long did you stay in?
I would say a quarter of a second.
Yeah, it's about an eighth of a second longer than I think. I take cold showers not because I hate them. I hate them. I hate them. But, you know, there's some people say it's good for you.
And
I'm taking I'm taking cold showers in Colombia where the temperature is 70 degrees. And I'm still like about, I'm sure everybody in the house here with me is like, what is going on in Jason's room? But, okay. So out of 200 people, I'm just curious how many people out of 200 or so actually got in with you?
The vast majority, actually. Yeah. It was more surprising, you know, when you spoke to somebody that hadn't been in, that was more surprising than people. The queues to get in the water were huge. It was great. I mean, there was music blaring. They really, like, the crew really kind of, the expedition crew really helped you kind of get in a vibe where you thought this is going to be fun rather than this is going to be terrible.
Is that something that you kind of like, was that on, I mean, you probably knew because you work for Intrepid, but
yeah.
Like the typical guest that booked this trip, was that like something that they, like it was written on the itinerary, day three, we're going to jump in really, really cold water? Or was it more of a, hey, we got something exciting for you to do tomorrow? What did that look like?
So we do mention it on the site as something that, you know, may happen on the trip. This is the other thing I realized about Antarctica is it's so weather dependent. You know, everything that you do, like the expedition crew, you know, will do everything to keep you safe. And if that even means not doing some of the activities that were planned on a particular day.
Especially jumping into ice cold, yeah, frigid, right? Water in the middle of a storm.
There's no negotiation on that, right? You know,
I can't even imagine that the insurance company covers that. They probably,
I mean, you know, you are
200
you are,
people.
You are a 2-day sail away from, you know, the nearest hospital, right? Like it's, you know, the crew were amazing, but everything was weather dependent, you know. So we, you know, of course there was a rough itinerary that we think we're going to follow, but if the weather didn't permit it, we did something different. You know, if one particular bay or inlet or collection of islands were, you know, rough on one day, we would go somewhere else and come back to a different location. So we didn't know when we were going to do it. You know, they kind of, every day there's a morning briefing and an evening briefing, and they'd said, you know, we're aiming to do it tomorrow. And in the end, we did do it that day. But you know, the beginning of the trip, they won't necessarily know when you're going to do it or where you're going to do it, because the weather's so changeable as well. You know, it one day can be beautiful sunshine, and the next it's absolutely howling wind and, you know, snow just coming sideways at you.
And you're thinking, oh, we're going to jump into this maybe tomorrow if the weather. I went to a Tony Robbins event. Some of the listeners might be familiar with that. He does some stuff, and it's like a 4-day event that culminates with what they call the firewalk. Right. And you know it's coming, and there's a lot of talk about it. And it's interesting that when you get to that point, it's like the same thing. Most people do it. It's odd that you meet somebody that goes to the event that doesn't do it. And it's actually kind of a cool thing, because you kind of overcome some of your, you know, your ideas and fears about things. And a polar plunge in Antarctica sounds like just pretty much the same deal. So that's actually really cool. Was there anything else about that trip that maybe is a surprise people wouldn't know about, or that you want them to know about if they're considering something like that? Because I think it's on a bucket list for a lot of people. So I guess I should ask you this. What do they need to know to help get it off the bucket list and into their realm of experiences?
Sure. I mean, I think it is seen as a bucket list. I mean, look, I'll be honest. I never thought I would go to Antarctica. I just didn't think it was a place that normal people went to. But, you know, I think we run it as an expedition cruise. So that means it's on a smaller ship than your kind of big ship cruises. It does mean that, you know, it's really feels like an adventure. It really feels like an expedition, because you're kind of at the mercy of the weather. But that also makes it fun. You know, you feel like you're all in it together. So that's one thing I think customers probably should have in their mind. And the other thing is, you know, we've tried to make it as affordable as possible. You know, Intrepid is not a luxury travel company. You know, our premium range of tours is, you know, four and a half, five star sometimes. So it is at the kind of higher end for Intrepid, but still, you know, we're never going to be a luxury brand. And so we, you know, we wanted to go to Antarctica and be able to take customers to Antarctica in a way that was affordable, also felt like a real expedition. And, you know, I was fortunate enough to go kayaking, you know, sea kayaking. And, you know, we went on quite a few hikes. You know, almost every day there was a hike on land. And you don't have to do all of these activities, but for us, you know, it's not about the ship like a lot of cruising is. It's actually about getting off the ship, and it's about, you know, seeing the wildlife with nothing, you know, no window between you. It's about, you know, experiencing, you know, climbing up a mountain in Antarctica and getting that sense of achievement. So I think for customers, you know, there's probably some customers that think, oh, I would never want to do a cruise. You know, it's not my vibe. You know, for them, I would say it's more like it's like a genuine adventure, like a genuine expedition rather than a cruise. But also for those people that, you know, do just want to go down there and you know, happy to stay on the ship. You know, there were loads of lectures on the ship. You know, our crew is, I mean, I found them absolutely fascinating. You know, we had biologists on there. We had, you know, meteorologists on there. We had geologists on there. And the lectures were fascinating. So I think for people that, you know, don't necessarily want to go down there and feel the need to jump into, you know, minus degree water or go hike up a mountain.
So they're not going to feel pressured. Because I know some people are just like, oh, if anybody's going to pressure me to do something I don't want to do, I'm not going to go. Right. So I guess that was, because sometimes it's easy to say, oh, if you like this, if you like that, if you like this. Sometimes an easy question is, who is it not for? Is there anybody, any type of person you could think of that this is really not for?
The only person that I, or any type of person that I could think of, is for somebody that gets really seasick. I mean, you know, you are crossing the Drake Passage. It is one of the most, you know, I guess, or can be one of the most, you know, challenging stretches of water to get across if you do get seasick. Like I said, I was lucky both directions. I guess it would be pretty miserable if you really struggle. I mean, you know, everybody on the ship, or at least the vast majority of people, took seasickness medication. You know, there are ways and means that you can mitigate the impacts of it. But look, the reality is being on a ship for 11 days, even when you can get off it twice a day, if you really don't like boats, or if you really get seasick, of course, it's not going to be the perfect trip for you.
Is there, I know that there are ways to get there on a plane. I'm not sure if there's ways that are commercially viable, but do you know? I feel like you probably know a little bit more about Antarctica than I do.
I mean, there are kind of overhead flights that you can do. Like, you know, you can fly down there and kind of look at it, but they don't land as far as I know. There are flights going down there, but I think it's mainly to the research bases.
Yeah.
I'm sure that there probably are. There probably are.
I know there's a mountain. I know there's a camp, the highest mountain in Antarctica. I know there's an operation there that you can fly in and summit that, but I don't think you're going to see along the coast.
As far as I know, what you guys saw
would be hard to do without a boat, I think.
Totally agree. Yeah. I mean, most things are doable if you've got enough money.
Well,
right. But
you can also go on a submarine to see the Titanic, I think, too. I heard something about that. So,
yeah, I
mean, we're not going to talk about that.
But. No. But look, I think for me, the being just, you know, the ship in a little bay, you know, being able to stand out on deck in the evening, I think that was part of the magic for me. And I think if you're flying in, seeing it and flying out, you're actually missing out on a lot of what Antarctica is.
No, and I think I was just thinking that person that knows they're seasick, that the idea of being on a boat seasick, maybe because they've had an experience in the past, is like, okay, I'm not going. And I didn't know if you'd say, oh yeah, Jason, we offer a trip. You can fly down and land at the airport. And
we don't have one, but I'm sure they exist.
Anyway, that's pretty cool. And we've been chatting about a lot of stuff that I didn't even know we would have a conversation. You know, as I told you earlier, these are completely unscripted. We started the conversation, had no idea where we'd go other than I definitely wanted to make sure to share a little story about Antarctica. And I also was really, I think I told you last time we spoke, I came across a blog post that you had done about a trip that you had taken with your mom, right? To Scandinavia. Where did you go?
Iceland.
Was it Iceland? That was the ice. Okay. Yeah. And I just thought that was cool. And I've done a couple trips with my mom. So every time, you know, as I'm having these conversations, I kind of like to bring it up because I hope that someone will listen to it and make a decision to take their parents, even if they don't think their parents are travelers, want to travel. If you're the type that's listened to three or four of these podcasts, I'm going to assume that you like to travel. And just want to kind of encourage people to do that. So just tell us the kind of the highlights of what that meant for you, what it meant for your mom, and what advice you'd give to anybody that's listening to this is like, oh my gosh, I would never travel with my mom, my dad. That would be boring, stressful, whatever, you know, fill in the blank.
Yeah. I mean, look, Intrepid, you know, most of what we do is small groups. So most of our trips have a maximum of 12 or 16 people on them. So the first thing I'd say is, it's not just going to be you and your mum or dad, if that's what you're concerned about, right? You know, there are loads of other people on the trip. Or, well, I mean, you know, up to.
Or maybe that's the issue, Tom. It's like, you know, when you were in high school and your mom showed up to pick you up at school, and you're like, I don't want to be seen with her. I don't know, but go ahead.
I mean, I think it's probably, you know, the feedback we get most often from our customers is, you know, in some cases they were nervous about traveling on a group trip. Actually, when they come back, people make friends for life on Intrepid trips. Yeah. People, marriages have happened after people, you know, from people that have met on Intrepid trips. You know, I think that is a real selling point, actually, because a lot of the time you're meeting like-minded people. And actually, age, for example, in this case, is irrelevant. You know, it doesn't matter whether somebody is 25 or 65. You know, I think what unites a typical Intrepid traveler is a mindset more than necessarily their demographics. You know, you talked about it earlier, you know, that curiosity. You know, we often talk about our travelers, Intrepid travelers, as being curious, connected, and conscious. And, you know, for people that feel like that, you know, they will meet so many great people on Intrepid trips. And actually, you know, on the trips I've been on with my mom, I've taken two now, one to Iceland and one to the Galapagos, you know, my mum met people on that trip that she has since connected with. You know, I probably keep in touch with other people from the group. And so I felt like the age was irrelevant. You know, even the connection, it was never particularly stressful. And I think for me, the joy of it. You know, working in the travel sector, you know, I've been so fortunate to travel to plenty of amazing places. But I do think it's possible to get a little bit, you know, kind of blasé about it. You're kind of like, oh yeah, I go to these amazing places. I work in the industry. You know, it sounds a bit like, you know, for people that don't work in the industry, think, oh, shut up. You know, I'm here, yeah, and I'm, you know, going on two holidays or two vacations a year. And so, you know, seeing the passion that and the amazement and the wonder that my mum had for seeing some of these places. And, you know, I'd never been to Iceland or to the Galapagos before going with my mum. And, you know, but I'm probably a little more reserved. She's like fully emotional about it. She was just could not contain her excitement and wonder. And that was amazing. You know, I got more excited about being there because I saw how excited she was about being there. And that made it totally meaningful.
It's so fun to see that, especially if you've kind of not, I'm going to say numb to it because I can't think of another word. I don't think that's the right word, but if you've been to a place or been on a certain type of thing at some point, it's like, oh, here's another interesting place. But when you get to experience that through someone else's eyes, especially someone you're close to, that can be incredibly exciting to, because you're sharing a couple things. One is you're sharing that moment, that experience, but you're also sharing, you know, something that's meaningful to you. And that's travel and exploration, frankly, even maybe, you know, intrepid. You know, I know that I traveled to Africa with my mom, took her to Belize, the Bahamas. I've been on a few trips and they've always were with Orvis. I was representing Orvis. And I took my dad to Belize on a fly fishing trip once as well. And it was actually really fun because they got to see me kind of in my work element with my clients. They got to see, oh, this is a real job. They could see that I was working hard. But I also got to see, you know, their awe through, you know, the things through their eyes, share those experiences so easily. I've been fortunate to see some really cool things. Maybe not at the level you have, but I've seen some really cool things. And if someone were to ask me, what are your top, you know, two or three favorite trips? I guarantee one of them is going to be the trip to Africa with my mom. And I've been to Africa without my mom as well. But it was like just that was such an incredible experience. It was a group trip as well. Fun for her to get to chat with other people that, you know, and I mean, I don't know if this is ego speaking, but it was kind of fun for her. I think she felt proud that I was there leading the trip. So it was fun for her, you know, she's kind of like, yeah,
totally. Boy. Yeah.
So it was, and I'm just saying that was from my perspective. If someone's listening to this, you know, whether you're traveling all the time, or you work for a tour company, it doesn't matter. I think it's easy for us to imagine taking our children on trips. It takes a little bit more outside the box thinking to, oh, wait a minute, maybe I should take mom or dad. And take could mean, doesn't necessarily, you know, maybe they don't need you to take them financially, but take them, meaning go with them, spend that time with them. Because I don't know, as I get older, I think I appreciate that. I'm a little bit more sensitive that I'm like, it's a little harder for me to get my kids to spend time with me now. And if they were to reach out to me and say, dad, I want to go somewhere with you, that would be pretty meaningful. So I love bringing it up whenever it comes up because it's been so profound in my family. And when I read your post, before we spoke last time, I was like, oh yeah, it was really well written, by the way. So anybody listening to this, it was a pretty fun post to read. So, Tom, we've covered so much stuff. Is there anything that I forgot to ask, should have asked, or anything that you just, anything else you think is important for our listeners to know either about you, sustainability, intrepid, just anything at all that you want to cover before we wrap this up? And if there's other stuff, we can always come back and do another episode as well. So what do you think?
Sure. I mean, I think we've covered a lot of ground. It's been super fun. So definitely enjoyed our chat. I think the one thing for me that I would just add is, you know, especially in the United States and, you know, across the world, but especially in the United States, we are seeing a bit of a, and it sounds like I'm bringing it on a downer, but we are actually seeing, you know, an epidemic of loneliness, across, you know, a lot of places around the world, but especially in the States. And, you know, maybe you've seen some of the research about the impact that can have on people's health. And I just think, this is a great opportunity and travel is a great opportunity just to reach out, connect with people, you know, like you said, you know, with regards to family, go on a trip together, or even if you don't have somebody that you want to go on away with, or you don't think there's somebody that is, you know, at the same point of their life as you are, maybe they're not as free as you are to go on a trip. I think that's where group travel, and, you know, obviously I work for Intrepid, so I'd say an Intrepid group travel trip, you know, going on a trip can just really help you to reconnect with people, you know, whether it's your fellow travelers, whether it's, you know, local people in a destination, whether it's, you know, other Intrepid travelers on social media that, you know, you're sharing your photos and kind of reminiscing about it. And I just feel that, you know, travel has such an important part to play in helping people to connect to each other, that I just think, you know, that's where group travel can really add some value to people's lives. Cause, you know, I think it's really sad that there's this loneliness epidemic, that we're seeing. And obviously, you know, there's probably a number of factors. Part of it's probably the pandemic. And, you know, I think people are spending a lot of time on devices and not necessarily connecting with people in real life. So that's the final thing I'd want to say is just, you know, push yourself to travel, and I guarantee you'll be less lonely because of the great people that you'll meet.
I think that was a high note. I know you said I don't want to end it on a low note, but I think that was a high note. I'm so happy that you brought that up, because I agree with you 100%. And it's fun for, you know, folks like yourself, I know, and for me, when I've led group trips in the past, it is so much fun watching people connect. And sometimes, you know, and anybody that has some concerns, like, so many times, you know, you've got one person that shows up and you can tell they're just like, oh man, this is a little overwhelming. What have I signed myself up for? And then by the end of it, they're, you know, we're at the airport giving big hugs and just like taking pictures, and everybody. And I'm not, you know, I mean, everybody, the quietest, most reserved one is usually the one that's like, you know, yeah, let's do this again. They're like, where do you guys want to go next? So I'm happy you brought that up, because I think that's super, super important. And obviously, you know, I know of Intrepid's reputation, and I'm sure many people that are listening do. And if you didn't, when you started listening to this, set the reputation aside. You heard Tom speaking. You can probably already get a pretty good feel for it without doing any more research. That being said, Tom, I'll have your website link in the show notes underneath. So anybody that's listening to this that wants to reach out, learn a little bit more about Intrepid Travel, then absolutely do that. And I'm sure they can connect with you on some other way if there's some other, you know, the conversation that they want to have. I know that you would be potentially open to having that conversation. So, Tom, thank you so much. This was a really great conversation. I will never forget the story you just made up about your job interview. I know it was all fabricated because you're a great storyteller. That's the best, like, impromptu. My only question is that when that you planned ahead, or is that when you just literally just kind of impromptu? So anyway, and I want a candy bar.
I hadn't thought I would go down that route, but that's where the discussion took us, which I'm totally happy to do. So hopefully you and the listeners found it interesting or inspiring.
I suspect some of the people on your team, especially the report to you, that haven't heard the story will probably enjoy hearing it as well. So thank you so much for sharing it.
Thanks.
All right. Thanks a lot, Tom. Appreciate you.
Thank you. Cheers on you. Bye.
Bye.
I trust you enjoyed listening to the conversation as much as I enjoyed recording it. If you're enjoying the Big World Made Small podcast, please take a moment to tell the algorithm by subscribing and posting a review so that others can benefit as well. I also invite you to take a quick trip over to bigworldmadesmall.com and join our private adventure travel community to receive new episode notifications, special access to our guest experts, and perhaps even some exclusive partner offers that we haven't discussed on the podcast. I'll publish another episode soon. Until then, keep exploring. It's the best way to make a big world feel just a bit smaller.